Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It really is a radical difference between the order of a life oriented to creatures and a life oriented to machines.
It's a pleasure to have Wendell Berry on our show today. He'll speak about what it means to live a creaturely life. Some fish farmers want in on the organic movement, why the organic industry is hesitant. Will Allen inspires student gardeners to keep doing what they're doing. Scientists say hemp holds a tremendous amount of promise if only they could get funding to do some basic research. And parsnip pancakes are on the menu with Daniel Orr. The salad that goes with it is a bit of a surprise. The biggest story on Earth Eats Twitter this week came from the Pacific Northwest. Luann Johnson has details.
Seattle has become the first city that will fine its residents for throwing food waste into the garbage bin. The new law became official on the first of this year. Any household with more than 10% food waste in the garbage will be tagged with a red notice of infraction. Each household gets two notices, and on the third infraction, a fine will be levied. Fines don't go into effect until July 1st. Penalties will be up to $50 for apartments and commercial buildings. Single households will only be charged $1. The city provides compost bins and picks them up curbside for free. Other cities have implemented food waste bans for residential customers, including San Francisco and Vancouver. What makes Seattle's policy the first of its kind is the city will financially penalize residential customers. In 2012, Massachusetts became the first state to make it illegal for any large industrial business to throw away food waste. That law went into full effect in 2014. New York City also piloted a voluntary compost program across the city in 2013. Americans, on average, waste 20 pounds of food per person per month. On January 13th, the European Union passed a law allowing individual nations to ban genetically modified crops from being produced within their borders. Both those for and against GMO cultivation see fault with the new law. Monsanto spokesperson Brandon Michener argued the decision was misguided and would result in raised prices for European customers. Those in favor of banning GMOs were more concerned that this type of law would actually make it easier to bring in GMO crops to Europe. Member states are not allowed to object to GMO cultivation within their borders due to health or environmental concerns. They are allowed to object based on environmental policy, town and country planning, the socioeconomic impact, and the desire to avoid cross-contamination with other crops. Currently, only Monsanto's insect-resistant maize, MON-810, is approved to grow in the EU. The legislation will be finalized in March. And McDonald's is sticking to its pledge to be more transparent about its foods. The fast food giant released a video detailing how their French fries are made. It's part of the Our Food, Your Questions campaign. So yes, the fries are made of real potatoes, but they pick up a few additives on their way to the drive-thru window. 18 if you don't count potatoes as an ingredient. Dextrose homogenizes the color of the fries, while sodium acid pyrophosphate keeps the color from graying once frozen. The potatoes are partially fried before making it to the restaurant in a combination of canola, soybean, and hydrogenated soybean oils. We hope you'll seek these articles out on our website and then share them with your friends. The links are collected in one handy place at eartheats.org. Just click on the latest podcast post to find the list.
More about McDonald's from this week. CEO Don Thompson has said he will step down at the end of February. The fast food giant experienced one of its worst financial years last year. Find out about news like this when it first breaks by connecting with us on Twitter. All right, Luann Johnson, we appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Much of the fish you can buy in a supermarket is raised on a fish farm. Soon, some of it may be certified as organic, but it's hard to run a fish farm that's friendly to the environment. And some critics say certifying farmed fish as organic under new standards could fundamentally change the organic food aisle. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
Troutdale Farm sits at the end of a dirt road near the edge of Missouri's Lake of the Ozarks. An upwelling spring feeds about a dozen cement raceways filled with rainbow trout. Workers use a net to pull out basketfuls of fully grown fish.
Dennis and I took over the farm in 2002 and started basically doing a renovation of the whole site.
For Troutdale owner Merritt Van Landit and her husband Dennis, that meant reworking the water system and dropping the use of any chemical additives, growth hormones, or antibiotics.
We just decided to build a system that seemed like it could actually be more sustainable into the future.
When it comes to organic certification, there are strict guidelines for food producers to follow. Think about organic steak. The cow it came from has to be raised on organic feed. The feed mix can't be produced with pesticides, chemical fertilizers, or genetic engineering. The Troutdale fish aren't technically organic because there aren't any standards for organic fish in the U.S., but that could change soon. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is considering a set of rules, according to Miles McAvoy, the deputy administrator of the USDA's organic program.
This National Organic Standards Board worked for a period of years and put together a series of recommendations on organic aquaculture.
The recommended standards suggest guidelines for how fish can be grown organically in pens in the ocean and how much wild-caught fish can be used in fish feed.
What the National Organic Standards Board recommended was that there would be some allowance for non-organic fish feed that would be phased out over a 12-year period of time.
It's not 100% organic, and organic requires all animals to have an organic diet.
Lisa Bunin is the organic policy director at the Center for Food Safety. She says diet is important, and she's concerned about raising farmed fish in the ocean. That's because farmers can't control what toxins the fish are exposed to, and the fish farms could be a source of pollution.
The particles from these facilities eventually settle on the ocean floor and can dramatically alter the oxygen and reduce the population of bottom-dwelling animals.
Consumer groups like Food and Water Watch and the Consumers Union agree. The organic food market is exploding. It's worth about $35 billion a year, and fish farmers and retailers want in. But some in the organic industry say not so fast. They're wary of the impact less stringent regulations could have on other organic foods. Here's Nathaniel Lewis with the Organic Trade Association.
There will be a significant consumer education piece involved in what is the difference between a conventionally farmed fish and an organically farmed one, and how does that relate to the difference between a conventional egg and an organic egg.
Still, fish farmers and scientists are working to create more sustainable aquaculture. Some farms are using closed-loop systems that recycle water. And researchers are experimenting with fish feed made from ingredients like soybeans and animal byproducts. Back at the Troutdale farm, workers are harvesting rainbow trout that will end up on tables in Kansas City and St. Louis. Merritt Van Landit says she'll have to see if her customers want the organic label and what that would cost.
It's really fun to go out and play with the fish, and it's really nice to see those little legs grow. But darn it, you're still a business.
The USDA plans to publish its organic standard proposal for farmed fish by summer. That will open up a public comment period of at least 60 days. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
In the second half of our program, why scientists are having a hard time learning more about hemp. We're celebrating a milestone on Earth Eats this week. Today is our 300th episode. To mark the occasion, I'm bringing out a very special interview from our archives with farmer, author, and environmental activist Wendell Berry. Mark Bittman has called him the soul of the real food movement, and Michael Pollan says Berry's writings helped him form his own thoughts on gardening. He's sitting down today with Shauna Ritter of WFIU.
You said that you were writing historical fiction about your own life.
That's true.
How does that feel?
Well, it feels like great historical changes must always feel when they happen within one person's life. But the change that I've been talking about is that up until the end of the Second World War, the life that I experienced was predominantly creaturely. After the war, it became dominantly and increasingly mechanical. And I think the change from a creaturely life to a mechanical life is a profound change, and in many ways it has been devastating, not to me, but to the country itself.
Can you talk a little bit more about the effects of moving from a life that was dependent on working with animals to a life that is dependent on machines in terms of communities, small communities?
Well, we've tried in the sciences and in other ways to understand the creatures as machines. But I think that's a failure. There is no real resemblance between creatures and machines, and there is no resemblance between the relationship that a person has with a machine and the relationship that one has with an animal, particularly a working animal. It really is a radical difference between the order of a life oriented to creatures and a life oriented to machines.
I think it's in Hannah Coulter. She speaks about the difference between before the war that people were dependent on each other in the community. And once machines came into being, they had to look outside in order to be able to subsist. Can you talk a little bit more about the changes on communities that difference in focus has
brought?
Well,
there is a vast difference from a life drawn from the ground underfoot, so to speak, and a life that is drawn from distant sources that are difficult or impossible to know and take responsibility for. So what we've done because of cheap fossil fuel and therefore cheap long-distance transportation is to substitute a life that was economically intimate, coming from known sources, to a life that is commercial, remote from its sources, and therefore in a fundamental way ignorant and unfeeling.
Talk a little bit more about the notion of economic intimacy, if you would. It's not a phrase we often hear.
Well, I grew up among people who did shop in stores for coffee and seasonings and bananas, maybe, but who lived largely from their own land. When you've done this over a period of time, especially when you have the perspective of a changed time, you realize that living from your own place, eating food from your own place, makes you one flesh, so to speak, with that place. This, insofar as it's conscious, is profoundly intimate.
You use the phrase, so far as it's conscious. How do we, at this point in time, make that more conscious for people who are no longer living on the land?
Well, in the days before cheap long-distance transportation, when a subsistence economy really was the backbone of family and community life, it was pretty much taken for granted. People had never done differently. So it becomes conscious, and to some extent, because it has become rare. It's now again becoming less rare. But the poet Yeats said somewhere that things reveal themselves going away. And for some of us, as we began to lose the old way of rural life, what it had been became vividly clear to us, what it was that we were losing. And then the ones of us who have tried to remain faithful to that old way it has been conscious in a way that it wasn't before.
Author, farmer, and environmental activist Wendell Berry. That is just a portion of the hour-long conversation with WFIU's Shauna Ritter. We'll post that on our website. Listen to it in its entirety at eartheats.org. Coming up, we go into the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr. He's got two of his favorite ingredients.
Add a little bit of garlic and a little lemon zest. So if you're going to make these into breakfast pancakes, you'd probably leave the garlic out, unless you're a real garlic lover.
These are not for breakfast. Parsnips in here, in addition to the lemon zest and garlic. Listen to what goes on top of these pancakes. Maybe you can guess. That's coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick, Cadillac Boulevard, and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Parsnips.
Yeah, why don't you give these a little taste now?
Hi, Annie Corrigan in the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr. Ooh, sweet.
They're actually sweeter than carrots.
And you're with Earth Eats.
You can use these, like we're going to use today, as kind of canapes, but you could also serve these for breakfast if you wanted to make them a little sweeter. You could add a little molasses or maple syrup or sugar to the mix and go ahead and serve these right for breakfast. So what we're going to do is we're going to mash these up. Okay, so to this I'm going to add a little heavy cream. Okay, we're going to add a couple of nice farm fresh eggs. Add a little bit of flour to bind it. Add a little bit of panko breadcrumbs. Okay, I'm going to add about a tablespoon of olive oil. And what oil or butter does in a pancake mix is it keeps the gluten from forming, so you have nice, tender pancakes. All right, and we're going to add a little bit of garlic and a little lemon zest. All right, we're going to bring these over to the griddle. Just putting a little nonstick spray on that.
We're going to wait for those to cook a bit before we assemble our topping. A little patience here. Daniel will be back with us in about 7 minutes. Hemp is grown throughout the world for its oil and fiber, which show up in everything from beauty products to rope. Its chemical compounds might also hold the key to medical treatments for Parkinson's and epilepsy. But scientists say they need more research to unlock hemp's benefits. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, conflicting laws make it tough to get started.
Nolan Kane stands among rows of tomato plants at the University of Colorado Boulder.
So we're at one of the greenhouses on campus. This is Vermeley Hall.
Kane is an evolutionary biologist specializing in plants. He wants to grow cannabis, specifically industrial hemp. But it's not in the ground yet.
I am told that it is not the first cannabis that has been grown on campus, however, just the first legal cannabis.
Humans have been growing hemp for centuries. Hemp-based foods have taken off recently. So have lotions and soaps that use hemp oil. And there's evidence that different compounds in cannabis could be used as medicine. Cain says the plant holds tremendous potential.
It's one of those things that when you talk to people, it's hard to believe all the different uses. Because it really gets a little bit ridiculous, all the different things that people use it for.
Cain's latest project is to create a genetic map of cannabis. Unlike other major crops, like corn and wheat, there's no published map for the plant. In fact, Cain says there are tons of unanswered questions about the basic science. How many varieties of hemp exist? Where does it grow best? What chemical compounds make it up? All those questions need to be answered before drug companies, manufacturers, and farmers can get a handle on hemp's benefits.
What formal research is there has been good, but there just isn't enough of it, right? Because there aren't that many people that have been able to get funding and permission to do this anywhere, really.
That permission is rare, because even though hemp has little to no psychoactive properties, under federal law, it's in the same class of illegal drugs as heroin and LSD. Despite that, Congress may be warming to the plant, and the list of potential uses for hemp is long. But what might be the plant's most magic property? It can actually get Democrats and Republicans to work together. Here's Colorado Representative Jared Polis.
We were able to pass an amendment to the Farm Bill showing that there were a majority of Democrats and Republicans that felt that this is an important crop.
The Farm Bill passed last year included a last-minute amendment giving the green light to researchers who want to work on hemp. But it hasn't been a free-for-all for scientists. The sparse legislation that Congress has passed is vague.
Higher education is a fairly regulated environment.
That's Patrick O'Rourke, the University of Colorado's lead attorney. He wants to make sure the research doesn't put the university's federal funding at risk.
The message that we've tried to say is we support your ability to do any type of research that you want to do as long as you're going through the right steps to have it approved. And the researchers understand they don't want to be outside the boundaries of the law.
Despite the obstacles, the research is starting to take off. Colorado's two biggest universities, Colorado State and the University of Colorado, formed a joint partnership to share research on the plant. It's looking for funding now. And in the meantime, private companies are attempting to pick up the slack.
So this is the greenhouse warehouse.
John McKay is a plant geneticist at Colorado State University. His school will eventually start growing hemp, too.
I spent more time with lawyers this year than I have all of my previous years.
So instead of waiting for all of the federal approval, he started his own business, working out of a small greenhouse he rents off campus. He says the conflicts in federal and state law just make everything move so slowly.
Nothing is completely spelled out in law, and then what little has been spelled out, then agencies and universities are trying to use to make plans, and by the time we make them, then maybe the laws change again.
While those laws keep changing, McKay says scientists, both public and private, will be doing whatever work they can to fill the research gap in hemp. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Stories about food and field. They post them at harvestpublicmedia.org. Will Allen grew up working on a farm in Maryland. His father was a sharecropper. When he came back to farming later in life, he wanted to involve the whole community.
Being able to farm in a communal setting with others is because it's pretty lonely. Out on a farm, if you're row cropping or working by yourself, that's not a very fun way of working.
Allen is the CEO of Growing Power in Milwaukee. It's a not-for-profit urban farming center where locals come together to farm and learn and build community. He spends a lot of time these days traveling around the country, giving talks and touring gardens and inspiring the next generation of farmers. Last spring, he visited Indiana University.
What's happening here is I see all over the country in terms of student gardens like this. I like this one because they follow some of the principles that I use.
Raised beds in the back. He's also ushered through the greenhouse at the Hilltop Garden and Nature Center. The students look up to him, literally and figuratively. He's a foot taller than anyone else in the group. He played basketball professionally for a time. He's also a giant in urban gardening, especially aquaponics, the practice of raising fish and growing plants in a symbiotic system. Audrey Brinkers is a campus garden coordinator. She says Alan's visit puts their work into perspective.
I think it's definitely good for a lot of our members who see gardening on campus but don't really see that as part of a broader community.
Compared to growing power, the operation at Hilltop is tiny. But Alan assures the students that small gardens are just as important.
The best case scenario is for people to grow this in their backyard. Maybe on a smaller scale, but the same concept of being able to raise a percentage of their own food.
If you're not familiar with everything Growing Power does, from education to growing food to developing alternative energy sources, go to their website now. Spend just 5 minutes exploring growingpower.org. Back to the kitchen to finish up our dish for today. Chef Daniel Orr has put the second batch of parsnip pancakes on the griddle. Now he'll throw together a quick salad to spoon on top.
We're going to add some diced apples, sour cream, some fennel tops. You could also use dill or tarragon. Got some horseradish. Mix this up. We're going to add a little fresh lemon juice to this.
And the main ingredient, trout. Don't forget the trout.
And we're good to go. So that's how easy that is.
At this point, we've got sous chefs and servers all starting to gather around to see what we're cooking.
How are we looking on these baby pancakes?
These are looking great. Just going to let them get a little more color. Because that color is caramelization. What caramelization is, it's the natural sugars within the parsnips caramelizing. So that's going to add a touch of sweetness to it. To the pancakes, which will really play nicely off the smoked trout salad.
Ah, that's a pretty one.
That's got a nice big hunk of parsnip in the middle. Okay, top them with a little of your salad. And those are our parsnip pancakes with smoked trout salad.
The platter went out to the dining room for folks to try. We luckily snapped a picture right before all these pancakes with the trout salad were devoured. See the photo and the recipe at eartheats.org. We make it happen every week with the help of Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Lauren Glappa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the Reporter Collective at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33-RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We call that a wrap on our 300th Earth Eats episode. Thanks for being here throughout the years for stories about sustainable food and its people. Here's to another 300. I'm Annie Corrigan.